Turning today to Paul's letter to the Colossians, chapter 4 and verse 7. Colossians, chapter 4, verse 7. All my state shall Tychicus declare unto you, who is a beloved brother and a faithful minister and fellow servant in the Lord. And sermon title is Tychicus and Aristarchus. And perhaps, if time permits, a few moments on Archippus. But here in the seventh verse, the Apostle Paul comes to the close of the epistle and he extends greetings from others, his fellow workers, and salutations, and so on to the end. And these may just be read through hastily and thought to be formal, but they're far deeper than that. All my state shall Tychicus declare unto you, who is a beloved brother, a faithful minister, and a fellow servant in the Lord. Paul was seldom alone. He was alone sometimes, but he was mostly with his fellow workers, fellow preachers who served with him no matter how rigorous the journeys, how great the persecution, equally devoted with Paul to the work of the gospel. And here is Tychicus, an Asian convert to Christ. We're on to the second generation now as we go through this epistle. You know, the work began in Jerusalem, but now the Gentile mission has been going for some years. In fact, Tychicus has been with the Apostle Paul in the closing stages of his third missionary journey. That was some 4 years before this present imprisonment in Rome, from where Paul writes this letter to the Colossians. Tychicus had been with him through thick and thin for a number of years. His name means fortuitous in Greek, or fortunate, or lucky. But of course, in coming to Christ, he'd found something infinitely more certain and stable than luck or fortune, as the saying goes. He had been joined with Paul's preaching group for quite some while. He'd been a companion to Paul earlier in this first Roman imprisonment, not as a convicted person, but as a voluntary prisoner, and maybe there'll be time to mention that later. He'd been on major visits. He took this letter to the Colossians. He took the letter to Philemon. Later he would take the letter to the Ephesians. He was the bearer of letters, but he was a preacher. And when he went, he would preach and comfort the church, the term used here, and proclaim the word and the gospel. So he'd been on major visits. He was going to be sent with the letter and to tell them of Paul and his circumstances and what the Lord had enabled him to do in Rome, so that they wouldn't be discouraged at the fact that the apostle was in prison when they heard the remarkable influence that had been accorded him. And he'd learn of their situation and, of course, preach to them. But I want to look at the terms. All my state shall Tychicus declare unto you, who is a beloved brother. I remember once, if you pardon me telling you this, I was leaving the church during the day. Maybe it was 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. I can't remember, by the side door at the rear, which leads to the bookshop. And I was going out of that entrance, which is the entrance, as you know, for anyone visiting the office who will ring the bell and visiting the bookshop. And I opened the door, and to my surprise, I was confronted by a very large gentleman, an American pastor, and behind him, ranged down the steps, were about 20, 25 people who were his party. He was leading them on some sort of a tour, and they'd come to see the tabernacle. And I ran right into this gentleman, and he was very warm and very friendly. I didn't know who he was. I'd never met him before, naturally. And he bent over to me, and he said in a sort of confidential whisper, "May I ask who you are?" "Of course." And I told him, and immediately I told him, he turned round and bellowed to all his people on his party behind him. He said, "This is my very dear friend, the pastor of the church," and named me, except he got my name entirely wrong. But I was his very dear friend. And, that's very nice. But the Apostle Paul, I want to say, never used language like that. If he calls somebody a beloved brother, or a dear friend, or words amounting to the same thing, he meant it. They were full of significance and meaning. I remember going back years, so that you won't have the remotest idea of any of these folk. I was talking to a young man, and he had taken up blogging. I was trying to discourage him, but he badly wanted me to see his blog and to comment on it. And one thing caught my eye, nothing about the blog, but he happened to be making a comment about somebody who he described as his very dear friend. Now, I knew both these young men, and they'd been flat sharers earlier on, and they didn't get on, because the person he was speaking of was such an awkward customer, and he was very difficult to live with, and he wasn't at all considerate or understanding, and so they had a little bit of a rough passage. But now, suddenly, he's calling him his very dear friend. And I said to him, "I didn't think you two really hit it off. Have you come to a much better relationship?" "Oh no," he says, "but you've got to be polite in a blog and say nice things about people." I just want to say the Apostle Paul never used language like that. If he says something, he means it. And so we need to explore the terms, because these are very significant and stirring and challenging to us. So here in verse 7, Tychicus, who is a beloved brother. That's the first of three terms that he uses. A beloved brother. He is a lovable brother, he meant, in the best sense of the term. He said, "I love him, and he deserves to be loved, and you cannot help but love him." So let's explore. What makes a person genuinely lovable? And when they do go wrong or do some minor thing which is aggravating to you, you scarcely notice it, because you love them and you have such regard and respect for them. What made Tychicus a greatly loved brother? Well, obviously he was a brother by conversion, but greatly loved because he must have been a man of holiness for Paul to say this, a beloved brother. He must have lived a godly life. I think we may take that for granted. He must have been devoted to Christ, somebody who clearly loved his Lord and was devoted to him. Sometimes, tragically, that isn't all that evident, even in a professing Christian, that he loves the Lord. I remember a wife saying to me of her husband, rather hesitantly, "I think he loves the Lord." Didn't she know? Wasn't it obvious to her? That's rather sad. I think with the case of Tychicus, he was obviously devoted to the Lord. that would make him a beloved brother, surely, in Paul's estimation. Then he was valued and helpful. A person who is helpful is somebody who is loved. He would get on with background tasks. He wasn't a man looking for acclaim or notice or glory. He'd pick up things that needed to be done. I'm elaborating. I'm trying to explore what makes this servant of Christ so eminently lovable. And then he was friendly, surely. A person can be very helpful and very active and rather cold. And you don't instinctively find that person lovable. A beloved brother, beloved sister. No, I think he was a friendly man. Even when he was depressed, he didn't shed his sadness on everyone around him. He attempted to project Christian contentment and to bring some warmth and to think of the other person and to ask after them and engage with them. He was a friendly person. You know, there are some people who bring friendship and there are some people who bring burdens. I believe this is part of this beloved brother. He was a friendly man. He was a truthful man, surely. He could be frank, even with the apostle, if occasion demanded. There are some people who will not be frank. They'll be nice to you, but not really truthful. They might mislead you, thinking they're being polite. But he was always truthful and thoughtful and forthcoming. He wasn't just dumb, not trying hard. He would contribute, a thoughtful man, certainly a sacrificial man, a generous man with his time and with his effort. The Apostle Paul wanted to send somebody to Ephesus and it couldn't be done. So at the last minute, he asks Tychicus. Tychicus will not hesitate, even though it's highly inconvenient and it cuts across his plans. He's sacrificial. He's available. If he's asked to go to a place like Philippi, for example, that means trouble, he'd still go, even though it means persecution and difficulty. He was a sacrificial man, a generous man, unstinting with his efforts. He was faithful, always available, always would pull himself up and together and respond to the task. All those things, I'm sure I'm entitled to mention them all, would make this man a beloved brother, a deeply appreciated person. It's a challenge to us, isn't it? Are we beloved? Easy to love? Deeply appreciated? Am I must ask myself. Why not? What must I do? With the Lord's help, to be a beloved brother. And then I must hurry up because he's also a faithful minister. Now the word minister translates the Greek word for deacon, for servant. But minister is used rightly in our translation because Tychicus was a servant of the word and a servant of the Lord. He was a minister, so the deacon word is translated minister. But you know what that deacon word comes from? It comes from the Greek for a runner. You know, a runner in time of war, before radio communications came in and took over. A runner had to be sent down the front line to give instructions to an adjacent unit or local commander. And that was dangerous work. There was shelling going on, and fire, and sniper fire. And those runners had to run for their lives. But they would go, and they would carry all the messages this way and that way. And many of them were shot. And we read in war histories of the high number of runners who gave their lives. So they were not invariably carrying arms, but they were men of courage and athletic capacity. And the deacon term comes from that, a runner, or somebody in the employment of a local mayor or authority who did heralding and ran here and there. Literally, a runner had to put efforts and courage into the work. And from that, the word servant came, and servant of the gospel. So bear that in mind. It's a loaded word, a faithful runner or servant or minister, faithful to the Lord. Tychicus maintained his private devotions, was always in prayer, never took a mission without much prayer, never preached without prayer, cast himself upon the Lord, represented him, stood for him, spoke of him, was faithful to the Lord. He was faithful to the word. He was careful with his preparation and accurate and sought to represent the word as faithfully as he could. Every doctrine of the word, he just wasn't a one-note person, a one-drum person. He would preach the whole range of truth, the gospel, the doctrines, the comforts, the warnings, because he was faithful, not just what he liked to do. And he was faithful to souls. He had a heart for them, and he prayed for them, and preached for them. He wasn't an aggressive preacher who just harangued people. He knew how to be firm. He knew how to be deeply sympathetic and consoling, because he was faithful to his hearers, to minister to them, to help them and advance them and lift them up. And he was faithful to the church, faithful to its order and its peace. Four special areas of faithfulness for a minister of the word, and he could be commended to them by the apostle. And then thirdly, he's a fellow servant in the Lord. The Apostle Paul doesn't duplicate his speech. It's quite different, this fellow servant. The word means literally a fellow slave. It's the Greek for slave, a fellow slave in the Lord. That's how the ministers of those days saw themselves. That's how all Christians saw themselves. Slaves of Jesus Christ. Not by compulsion, as slavery in the world, but willing and voluntary slaves for Christ Jesus, the Lord of glory. Now a slave was owned and commanded by his master. And a servant of the Lord, a true Christian, is owned and commanded by the Lord. He, she says, I am not my own. I am a slave, willingly, of my Saviour. And that's how Tychicus and all of them saw it. They didn't have salaries and stipends in those days any more than a slave would. A slave didn't even receive pocket money. Nothing for the slave. He ate from his master's table. I'm not in the least, you understand, supporting slavery. But this is just to illustrate. He ate from his master's bounty. He took whatever he was given. He was entitled to nothing. And so were the servants of God in those days. As Christ provided for them, so they subsisted. But they didn't have salaries and earn great sums. You read of some people, some celebrity ministers earning fortunes. Wasn't like that in New Testament days. They were dependent upon the Lord's provision for them. There were no terms of employment. There were no holidays for slaves. There was no prospect, or not much prospect, of promotion for a slave. Oh, it's true that here and there, there were some slaves that could be promoted to be stewards of the estate, but that was a rare privilege for an outstanding slave in a large household. Mostly, there were absolutely zero prospects that life would ever be any different. Antiochus didn't look for prospects. He didn't say, I'll go to Ephesus, I'll go to Colossae, I'll endure this, I'll endure that, because one day I'll be the pastor at such and such a place, and settled and provided for, and a nice home. He didn't think like that. To my dying day, I will be doing what I'm doing, and I look for nothing for myself. That was the attitude of the pastor, minister, slave of early days. And although things are more settled now, and ministers and Christian workers have regular stipends of some sort, often not very much, nevertheless, they have the same spirit, or should have, and the same attitude. And so should we all. As Christians, I'm a slave of Jesus Christ. Tychicus, verse 7, a truly beloved brother, a faithful minister, a fellow servant in the Lord. That's New Testament language. That's Pauline language. In the Lord, it means in union with the Lord. You can be a slave for Christ, but only if you're in union with him. Only if you're in reliance upon him. Only if you're doing it in his cause and for his dear sake. Then you can be lonely, lowly, and entirely committed to Jesus Christ. Be strong in Ephesians, Paul says it, be strong in the Lord, in union with him, in reliance upon him. And that was true of Tychicus. He trusted Christ. He'd found him. He loved him. He was completely indebted to the agonies that Christ bore for him and for all his people on Calvary's cross. He never forgot his debt. He'd known the power of the new birth. He believed in the resurrection of Christ and the life hereafter. And so he was given to him, a servant of Christ, a servant for Christ, and a servant increasingly like Christ. So, verse 7, Tychicus, so powerfully commended by the Lord. May I tell you a few things about Aristarchus? Verse 10. I'm passing over Onesimus for the time being. I think most of you know all about Onesimus, the runaway slave. He was a slave to Philemon. Philemon was a rich man who was a member of the church at Colossae. The church at Colossae met in Philemon's very large house. The pastor of the church at Colossae was Philemon's son, who we may just come to with a fleeting reference. So Philemon had had Onesimus as a slave. Philemon, on being converted, had started to treat his slave or slaves, we presume, with great gentleness and respect. And young Onesimus took advantage of this, and he ran away. But it was the law in the Roman Empire that a runaway slave must be returned to his master. And Paul found Onesimus, or Onesimus found Paul, we don't know how it happened, in Rome. And Paul was a prisoner in Rome. So how Onesimus came across him is a story we don't know, and it's untold. But Onesimus was converted, and he became faithful and approved among the Christians at Rome. And now Paul, who doesn't agree with slavery and wants slavery, nevertheless obeys the law and sends him back to Philemon with a kind of plea for his emancipation, that Onesimus in future would be treated just like a brother. It's all in Philemon, the letter to Philemon. Just as you would treat me, Paul appeals to Philemon, so treat Onesimus. If that isn't a plea for emancipation, what is? The law is obeyed, and the slave owner is appealed to. And he gladly responds, because he's a converted man too. So there's Onesimus, but it's Aristarchus I want to just glance at in verse 10. Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, saluteth you. Aristarchus was a Jewish convert from Thessalonica. He was at Ephesus when Paul preached there with him. He accompanies the Apostle Paul. In Acts chapter 19, he's seized by the furious mob who are after Paul. And he, Aristarchus, with Gaius, are seized and manhandled. And they're bundled into the theatre, the big amphitheatre at Ephesus. And the vast crowd is screaming out, "Great is Diana of Ephesus, of the Ephesians. Demetrius the silversmith has stirred up a great riot," and they're all entreated. Well, we read of him there, Aristarchus, as a companion to the apostle. He was with the Apostle Paul too on the last leg of that third missionary journey. What's he doing here in prison in Rome? And in the letter to Philemon, it doesn't mention that he's a prisoner with Paul. So he probably wasn't all the time. And the conjecture is that Aristarchus, can you believe this, is a voluntary prisoner. Now, Paul's first imprisonment was a little more lenient than the others. But it would seem, this is supposition, that Aristarchus chose to be in prison with him, to be his companion. Perhaps he had liberty to come and go to some extent, to relieve the apostle, to be sent as a messenger here and there. But while he was with the apostle, assisting and helping him as his companion, he had to be treated as a prisoner. And at night he had to be chained for security. And he had to know the rigors and the difficulties. It seems the degree to which some of Paul's fellow preachers would go to serve the Lord and to assist the apostle would even include voluntary imprisonment. Epaphras suffered the same, probably a voluntary imprisonment with the apostle Paul. I think that's a wonderful challenge and example to us. In Philemon, he's also called my fellow slave, fellow worker. Aristarchus loved the Lord, loved souls, and loved not his life or his comforts unto death. is another who receives noble commendation. But I want to close, time is practically up, with just a reference to Archippus in verse 17. Look at these curious words. They must have puzzled you. And say to Archippus, take heed to the ministry which thou hast received in the Lord, that thou fulfill it. Now I think there's little doubt he's Philemon's son, because in the letter to Philemon, he's included with the household. And he's commended as a fellow soldier. So he was a man who knew zealous service, but a young man. Question number one, why doesn't Paul, the apostle, address this directly to Archippus? Take heed to your ministry. Why does he avoid speaking to Archippus and say to the church at Colossae and its elders, you say to Archippus? It must be official. It must be a commission from the elders of the church and a charge to that from them. But it does seem to be some kind of a rebuke or admonition. And say to Archippus, take heed. Literally, observe, look at, examine the ministry which thou hast received. You've been officially appointed. You've received a commission from the church and from the Lord to pastor, to minister. Observe what you're doing. Examine it thoroughly. Sift it. And respond. See to it, we might say. Examine it and see to it. Take stock. Review. Focus. Was he distracted? Was he diverted into business affairs? Chasing after that too much? Might be all kinds of things. Sometimes a minister is tempted to travel too much rather than attend fully and adequately to his church. All ministers must travel a little and visit other churches and preach. There must be some exchanging going on. But here and there you'll find men who get a taste for this and makes a name for them, and they feel approved and wanted, and they go hither and thither, and their name in a region or a community perhaps becomes more important than the church at home. Might that have been a problem with Archippus? We're left to wonder. Was it home building? He'd grown up in a wealthy home. Was he tempted with his own home? Did he have fads and phases where he gave too much attention to the church extension or something like that? Or did he concentrate only on one aspect of the ministry, the teaching, and neglect the evangelism and the young as well as the old? Did he attend to all the departments of the ministry? Or was it that he was severely discouraged? Because all Christians, let alone ministers, will be attacked by Satan and know Satan's darkest hour and times when they're crushed by the temptations of Satan and drawn to despair and doubt. And there's a low patch. Was he discouraged? Did he need to take steps to ignore the suggestions of Satan and seek the strength of the Lord and redouble his efforts? He needed to watch his time. He needed to watch the departments in the church. He needed to review his syllabus Was his teaching balanced? Was there evangelism and doctrine and exhortation and bringing glory to the Lord? Did he watch himself? He's an example to the flock. Is he most carefully watching his own conduct? Is he watching out for error and intruders and deviations? We've read about the Judaizers and all the others and the Gnostics who would come in and pollute the church. Was he a defender of the faith? So many departments to watch. But here it is. Perhaps it's to make us think that we're not told or given a hint what the actual problem was. And so this applies to us all. Say to Archippus, take heed to the ministry which thou hast received in the Lord, whether it's Sunday schooling, or visitation, or shepherding, or family. Take heed, observe. We're out of time, dear friends. Tychicus, Aristarchus, even Archippus, they stir us to commitment. Our closing hymn is number 470.